read a number of your books going way back, but then I happened to look at the...
Other
books.
It frightens me. And, I did a autographic at Roman's in Pasadena on Saturday, and they had a whole table there with all the back titles. The new ones were on a different table, which I was ordering. And then they brought the back titles over for me to sign, what was left of them. And I looked at that list and I said, that's got to be four or five other guys. I can't have written all those books. That's crazy.
That's a tremendous output. And, of course, the new book, Depths of Glory, is more than 600 pages. So, Irving Stone, you're certainly a prolific writer. Are you still living in San Francisco?
No. My family, aunts, uncles, cousins, all moved down to Los Angeles in a four-caravan Model T Ford, thinking that Southern California was the land of the future and the golden age. They sold their homes and their businesses in San Francisco. I don't think they did any better in Southern California, but I must say that their children did. And I'm so stupid, it took me till the last year or two to realize that maybe that they had that in mind. I don't know.
Well, where have you been living? Los Angeles is your base, and you've been living there for quite a few years then.
Yes. Well, we have maintained a home in Beverly Hills since 1945. We were living out in San Fernando Valley with our two children went to a one-room schoolhouse, you know, and to make an appointment for our kids to play with some other kids, we had to make it 3 days in advance and chauffeur them there and back. It was a terrible burden. So my wife said, we're moving into Beverly Hills because they have one of the best school systems in America. And we're going to buy a house that's three or four blocks, no more than that, away from a good school so the kids can go out the back door on their skates or their bicycles and they can make friends at the school. And that's what we did. We bought an old Spanish fortress with walls 3 foot thick and windows so narrow that so that only Indians could shoot arrows through the narrow apex. You know, I don't know. It was built by a Hungarian, the brother of the man who wrote Fata Morgana, Theatre Guild production. So we tore out all of those walls. We left the basic outside walls and a structure, cement structure, and we built an all-glass modern. And we lived there until our kids were through with school and away to college. And then we moved into a smaller place. It's known as the accordion system of family raising. You have a small apartment, and then the kids come, and you have to have a larger one and a larger one, and the kids begin to drift out, and pretty soon you're back in the small premises again.
That's better, too, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's better, too. The
small
place is better.
I think it works better that way. Yeah.
Well, let's go back a ways and work our way up to Camille Pissarro. I know that you were born in 1903 on Bastille Day, which seems to be a very fitting date.
I think so. It made me very partial to all things French. I speak the language fairly well. When I stopped teaching at University of California at Berkeley, I went to Paris because in those days, H.L. Mencken and Robert Nathan of the American Mercury said that if you want to be an artist, you have to live on the left bank of the Seine. So a lot of us absorbed that nonsense, and I did go, and I wrote in about a year and a half, I thought I was a playwright, I wrote 19 full-length plays and 31 one-act plays. I'd finish one at 6 o'clock at night, go have dinner with friends, and 8 in the morning, next morning, I would start the new play. No one had told me you can't do that. No, I didn't know that Ibsen kept a play in his mind for 2 or 3 years, maturing it, before he put it down. But I was very young. I was only 23, 24 years old.
Yes. That was 1926 that you went for.
That's right.
And so you became an expatriate for a time. How long were you there?
I was there for there and in Italy for about a year and a half. Then I came back to New York wanting to have producers accept my plays and put them on, but they were reluctant, to say the least. And so I made a living first by writing confession stories. You're not old enough to remember a magazine called I Confess. These are all anonymous stories written by pure young girls who go to work in an office, very young, and they fall in love with their bosses, and then, to use a phrase that fortunately we've lost in our language for a long time, they love not wisely, but too well. And after a year of that nauseating stuff, I stumbled into a friend's apartment for dinner, and they weren't home yet, they were delayed, and there was a detective magazine. And I had time to read 2 or 3 of the stories, and I said to myself, I can write these stories. And so I wrote a half a dozen, and I sent them out to the very best detective magazine, Black Mask and Detective and all, and they were all rejected. So I sent them out to the second line detective magazines, and they were accepted. So I realized I was a second-rate detective story writer.
Mm, but not a second-rate novelist, that's for sure. That's a strange profession for you to have embarked upon, knowing that you had studied economics in college.
Well, it was a way to make a living. I knew I was going to write my books. I was, you know, my genes inherited from somewhere about a dozen generations back have dictated to me from the age of 9 that I'm going to write books. And all through the years, I haven't cared about magazine articles. I was an art critic for the Los Angeles Times Mirror for a year just for fun. But the book, to me, is the great creation of man. It's greater than, let us say, cement or the wheel or even running water. But all of our wisdom and all of our knowledge and joy is right in the two covers of books.
Irving Stone, your first big smash was Lust for Life. When was that published?
Well, it was published in 1934. But before we emphasize on the word smash, let me tell you that it was rejected by the 17 leading publishers in America over a 3-year period while I half starved to death, and all on the same grounds. They liked the manuscript, but they said, how do you expect us to sell a book about an unknown Dutch painter in the midst to the American public in the midst of a depression? And Vincent was unknown then. The great exhibition 1936 at the Museum of Modern Art didn't come till 2 years after the book was published. And finally, Longmans Green, an adjunct of the great London house, very old house, took a gambling chance. The mayor, when I went in to congratulate the owner, he said, we printed 5,000 copies and we're praying. And I must say that he must have known the right God to pray to, because he and his children and grandchildren have been collecting royalties for 51 years on that book.
And so have you.
Yeah, so have I. Yeah. And my children and grandchildren, too.
I hope so, yes. I believe it was Kirk Douglas who was in the movie version, wasn't it?
Yes. Kirk Douglas played Vincent van Gogh and did a very good job, because she spent a number of months studying the painting as a painter. And you remember that the Academy Award went to Tony Quinn. Remember? He played Gauguin.
Yes.
Very vivid.
It's strange. I was watching, I didn't watch it all, but I just happened to notice on television last night, Kirk Douglas was in a TV film called Amos, and he looked just like his portrayal of Van Gogh.
Really?
I don't know if you happened to see the movie.
No, I didn't. I just came in from California last night, and I didn't see it.
Except for the up-to-date settings. You look at that and think it's a television rerun of Lust for Life. Well, you went on after that marvelous biographical novel to produce many more biographical novels and also regular biographies. Now, this is something interesting to me, is why you decided to take a fictional approach to these biographies instead of doing as you have done with the novel or the book about Jack London, for example.
Yeah, Sailor on Horseback, yeah. Or Clarence Darrow for the Defense, or Men to Match My Mountains. Yeah. Well, it was a considered judgment. Let me tell you that from the beginning, I wanted to be a novelist. I made my way through a failed short story writer and a failed dramatist. And I wanted to write these books as novels. By the way, they're not fictional novels. They're biographical novels. There are 98% solid documentation. I spend 2.5 to 3 years documenting before I begin to write. But the real answer, I suppose, is this, and you can interpret it, and so will your listeners, in any way they want. Biographies, even the great ones, like Edel's many volumes of Henry James and the new 2 volumes on Dostoevsky by Dr. Frank, they are read by students and scholars, and they're published largely in the United States. My biographical novels, including Depths of Glory and The Agony and the Ecstasy and the one about Sigmund Freud, The Passions of the Mind, The Greek Treasure, these are published in 80 and translated in 80 different languages. If you would come out to my home in Southern California, we have what's known as the Stone Wall, capital S, capital W, and there are 800 volumes in 80 languages. In other words, I managed to achieve in India, in China, in the Soviet Union, in Brazil, in Iceland, any country that you want, and even in Persia. We have 6 translations there.
Wait a minute. Let's back. Did you say you have 800 separate volumes of your work?
Yes.
In that one room?
I think it's fabulous. It's kind of, it scares me a little bit, you know. But it's also a comfort, because every once in a while, I'm not inclined to doubts or anxieties or depressions, but every once in a while I get tired and I say, well, maybe this book's not going to come out that well. And then I turn to the stone wall and I say, you know, here are 800 volumes, and this one has got to be all right. I must be doing something to, as I should.
You have done something good, and I assume that some member of your family has cataloged all these books for you.
Not yet. I'm going to have to train my son to do that. He's a lithographer.
Well, it's interesting what you say, because I believe that most people, when they want to find out about the world around them, they do turn to fiction for this information. And it can be fiction about whether it's the story of a great artist, as you have done, or about the war, or about any period in mankind. Fiction seems to tell them this information better. It seems to me that scholarly works, straight nonfiction, sometimes wind up in libraries and on the shelves, but are not read by the vast majority of people.
Yes, that's true. And may I suggest a reason why? In the straight biography, there are three persons involved. There's the hero or heroine on the one side, there's the author, and there's the reader. And they go down parallel tracks. But those tracks rarely converge, so there's no emotional involvement. In the biographical novel, such as Depths of Glory here, there's only one person involved. I, the author, have spent 5+ years researching and getting into the brain, spirit, heart, skin, marrow, blood of Camille Pissarro, so that I become the hero. And my whole intention is that by the time you get down to the bottom of page 2 or 3, you forget that you're at CBS and that you live in New York and what your name is, and it's 1985, and you become Camille Pissarro, and you take all the beatings, the failures, and all of the times your face is ground in the dust. But at the same while, you enjoy all of those magnificent creative fulfillments that Camille Pissarro and all of the French Impressionists who were his friends and disciples enjoyed through their lives.
Well, let's talk about your approach to Depths of Glory. It's not unusual that you would select Pissarro, knowing that you've had success with Michelangelo and Van Gogh in the past. But you obviously had to do, you say, 5 years of research. You must have traveled the same roads that Pissarro trod in his early days in France.
What we tried to do, and in the Pissarro case we were extremely fortunate, was to live in and work in every apartment and studio he lived in and worked in Paris. And we went with 60 addresses and found 58 of them intact. You know, the French build out of stone. The Americans put zippers on their walls and tear them up and down. 58 of them we found, we measured, we photographed, we sketched, and then we had maps of all of France, and we went out to visit the country homes and studios of Claude Monet, Edward Manet, Degas, Renoir, Cezanne, Gauguin, Mary Cassatt, the great American Impressionist, Berthe Morisot, Seurat, whose play is so popular here, from his painting Afternoon on the Grand Jatte. We lived, actually, in Pissarro's homes, in Pontoise, where he had three of them, and then in his final home, which he managed to buy, although he didn't want to because he was afraid to go into debt and he wouldn't be able to pay the mortgage because he couldn't sell his paintings. But his wife, wonderful Julie, who took such a beating but supported the family, she insisted and bought it without his knowledge or consent while he was in England. And there he converted the barn at the back into a studio where he painted the last years of his life, and there we had permission to live and to work, and that's where I wrote a good deal of my material about that period in Pissarro's life.
You actually wrote a good portion of Depths of Glory in Pissarro's studio.
Oh, yes, good portion. And we wrote a lot of it in Paris, a lot of it in Pontoise. But let me explain briefly one thing. When I'm writing on scene, on location, as they say in Hollywood, I don't write chapter 1, page 1. I write character studies, sense of place, weather, the conflicts, the religious, the economic, the political, the wars, what they're selling in the markets, what the preachers are preaching on Sunday and the teachers teaching on Monday, and we go out to the beaches and the parks and we play with the kids. In other words, we become part of that community and speak their language and learn their values and their mores, and that's a wonderful way to get into the life of a community.
When you say we, you're talking about your wife.
Oh, yes, Jean. My wife, Jean. She's my editor in residence, and she's also a very good researcher on the Darwin book, The Origin, which was the one before Depths of Glory. In the Cambridge University Library in London, she got permission, which is very rarely given, to roam the stacks. I'd give her a list of 10, 12, 15 monographs, old newspapers, old books I want, and she'd roam the stacks and bring them back to me within half hour or three quarters of an hour. And she would locate and give me slips in the pages of where I would find the material I needed. But mostly she is editor in residence. I do four drafts, one in longhand on pen and ink on long legal sheets. Then my secretary, who can read my handwriting, and I can't, so I'm lucky to have her, she gives me type drafts, which we cut and slaughter and put little slips of white paper, A, B, C, in the back we put X, Y, Z, and she gives me four drafts on the typewriter, all correct, and that is the best I can do at that point. Then I give it to Mrs. Stone, who spends almost as much time editing as I do writing, and she tears it apart and says, this is repetitious, you're taking sides for your hero against good people, or you're wandering down the garden path. Beautiful scene, save it for your next book. It doesn't belong here.
It's incredible the amount of information. This novel runs, biographical novel, I should clarify that, runs more than 600 pages. When you developed all of this research material, how did you organize it? You must have had reams and reams of papers and books and things
well,
like that.
Well, we send home those dictaphone cassettes, and we send home long sheets of writing. My secretary types them up, and I also have a secretary if I'm living in Italy, the Agony and the Ecstasy, or in France for the Depths of Glory. I have a French or an Italian secretary. Bilingual, of course, and they type up thousands of sheets, and my secretary at home sorts them under three classifications. We triple check. One, chronology, everything that happened every year. Two, everything that happened to every individual in the book, because in the Depths of Glory, we've got about 100 main characters all related to Pizarro, and then we have the rest of it under mores, which is climate, food, religion, and everything of the lives around them. And I can get the sheet I need in about 30 seconds.
It's certainly an amazing accomplishment. So why did you select Camilo Pizarro for your subject?
Two reasons. First of all, he is the least known of all the names, great names that I mentioned, and I think that he is one or two or three of the greatest of all the painters, but he was quiet. He was an Old Testament prophet who painted the eternalities, and his canvases will fill you with joy and make you know your place in the universe and love your life in the world and the universe. And I wanted to do for Camilo Pizarro what Lust for Life did for Vincent van Gogh. As you know, it established him worldwide. The second reason is more important. Camilo Pizarro was either the tent pole, or if you want another figure of speech, the cement floor under the whole Impressionist movement. He and Claude Monet created the first Impressionist exhibition, which was reviled and called every dirty name in any language, and nothing sold. So the other Impressionists didn't want to exhibit again, but Camilo Pizarro said, yes, we must. And he twisted their arms, and he influenced them, and he begged, and he argued, and he borrowed money, and he got friends to rent empty apartments. And over the next 12 years, he put on the 8 exhibitions, Impressionist exhibitions. Now, had these 12 or 14 men and women never had the exhibits, they would have painted just as well and just as much, but they would have been 12 or 14 disparate names, and you would have had no way to relate them or to hold them together in your mind. But Pizarro said, if we stay together, if we become this Impressionist movement, we will all be known together, and we'll be loved, and we will be seen and shown and bought, and we will have a great period in art history.
He was right, too.
Oh, yes, he was right.
Irving Stone, you've spent a number of years working on Depths of Glory, and you're off duty now, I assume. What do you do when you're off duty? What do you read when you're off duty?
Well, when I'm on duty, I cannot read fiction, obviously, because it gets in the way of my writing. As an example, I was a very great Faulkner aficionado, and my bookstore had an order for first edition, so they sent me a copy of a book called The Fable, Faulkner's, and late that night I went into bed after my kids had been finished with their studies and gone to sleep, and I read Faulkner's The Fable for 2 hours. The next morning I went to my studio and I wrote 8 gorgeous pages of my own book. And then I went for lunch and I had a swim and I came back and I looked at the 8 pages and they were pure Faulkner. I had to throw them away. They were no good for me at all. So I don't, but I read mostly national and international politics and biography. Now, after we put in 5 years and 2 months on Depths of Glory, my wife and I, between delivering the manuscript to Doubleday and receiving the galleys is almost 3 months. So we take a nice long cruise somewhere where we loaf and read, and my wife crochets and does all the things she has no time for at home. Then in the fall, as now, we go out for two and a half months of telling people that there is a new book. Now, you know that last year there were published in America 44,000 new titles, brand new titles, and mine is only one. So we have to tell the American people we have a new book called Depths of Glory. So we travel, we go to, tomorrow night we go to Cleveland, then we go to Chicago, back home for an autographing at Hunter's, a big bookstore there, and then we go to San Francisco, Sacramento, Santa Barbara, come home for an autographing, and then we go to Huntsville, Alabama, Nashville, Memphis, then I'm lecturing at Johns Hopkins, and we're spending the next few months doing that kind of thing.
Affectionately known as a book tour.
Yes, it's a book tour. And
which works when the limousine doesn't break down.
Well, it started to smoke, and I started to tell the driver, you really should have taken care of this in the garage, but he wasn't very interested in that. But it enabled me to get a walk of 4 or 5 blocks over to your studio, which I would not otherwise have gotten, and I need, because every day of my life at home, I swim for a half hour to an hour, and that's why I have, as you can see, but your listeners can't see at the moment,